Hi, I'm Jody Carlton, neurodiverse relationship expert, and welcome to season 4 of my podcast, Your Neurodiverse Relationship. This season, I've asked Mona Kay of the Neurodiverse Love podcast to join me as co-host to talk about some pretty personal stuff. Mona and I both help partners and couples understand how neurodiversity is impacting their relationship, and also how to navigate difficult decisions and choices. We've identified 5 key steps for assessing your relationship challenges and determining a path forward for yourself and your relationship. For some of you, this means working with your partner to gain insight and tools for communication and connection, and also figuring out strategies that work for you as a couple, even though they may be pretty non-traditional. But hey, if it works, it works. For others, it will mean recognizing if and when it's time to end your relationship. Mona and I have both been in marriages with neurodiverse partners that lasted over 2 decades. And in this podcast series, we're going to share with you how we navigated our own relationships along the way. And let's just say we didn't know what we were doing. Mona and I are going to go deep into the good, the bad, and the ugly. In order to share these deep and vulnerable memories, we both chose to record this season without video, to prevent the distraction of talking to our screens. We know you will recognize yourselves and so much of what we have to share, and our hope is that you will feel less alone and that our journeys will help you in your own neurodiverse relationship. Welcome. What will we talk about today? Hi, everybody. This is the second episode in the Navigating Your Neurodiverse Relationship series that I'm doing with Mona Kay, the host of the Neurodiverse Love podcast. If you've missed the first episode, be sure and go back and listen to that, where we talked about assessing the risk and triaging your relationship risk. No matter what stage you're in your relationship, from dating to being in crisis with your relationship, it's important that you're able to triage and assess the risks that are there in your relationship. In that episode, Mona and I got really personal about our own relationships, and we looked back to see a lot of the things about our own marriages where there were major red flags for the relationship that we ignored, and just we share a lot of personal stories and experiences that will be helpful for you as well. And on this episode today, we're going to talk about step 2 in navigating your relationship. And we've entitled this second step as stopping the bleed. So once you've triaged and realized that your relationship, your partner, maybe your children, if you have a family, really suffering in some way, then this means that there's risk emotionally, psychologically, or maybe even physically. So this next step is also very important, and it's to focus on how you're actually bleeding out the most, to figure out how to prioritize what needs to be addressed first. So what types of interactions or behaviors are creating the most harm to you, to your partner, to your children, and how to actually stop that bleed first. That's the first thing that's got to happen before you can move on to actually figuring out what the root of some of the problems are. Just like if you go to the emergency room, they're not going to look at you and immediately prescribe antibiotics if you're bleeding out somewhere. They're going to stop that bleed first. The antibiotics are more of a long-term solution. And sometimes it'll be obvious in your relationship what's causing this, what the bleed is, and we've got to get that stopped first. Another analogy I use is you have to get out of the boxing ring. If you're in the boxing ring, you're highly antagonistic and it's very difficult. I mean, that type of dynamic does cause your relationship to bleed out. If you're consistently throwing punches or receiving punches, we got to figure out how to get you out of that dynamic. In November of 2023, I teamed up with Mona Kay, host of the Neurodiverse Love podcast, to facilitate a support group for individual partners who are struggling with difficult choices and decisions about their relationship. The support group is called Navigating Neurodiverse Relationships. We designed it to help people figure out what their options are, their path forward, and to just walk people through the steps of how to understand the choices they have in their difficult relationships. Ultimately, our goal is to help you get clarity on how you can save your marriage, if you can save your marriage, and what to do if you don't believe you can. For more information about the support group or to register for the next upcoming session, just visit me online at jodycarlton.com. So Mona, thanks again for doing this series with me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Okay, so I'm going to just go right on into stopping the bleed. When we look at our relationships, most of you who are listening to this podcast are in some way struggling in your relationship, or you wouldn't be here listening to this podcast. You're trying to understand your relationship. You may be really confused, and you may be early in the relationship and wanting to be proactive, or you may be in absolute crisis and on the brink of the relationship ending, and there's just such a huge disconnect. And this whole series is not just about sharing and teaching and guiding, but it's about Mona and me sharing our own personal experiences and getting really raw with what we experienced. And we went through this process, this five-step process, on our own without any support or help or guidance. And so when we've looked back, seeing the mistakes we made, seeing the things that influenced us, and, you know, like when I look back, I know my ex-husband and I, we had extremely intense ups. We had highs, really high, but then very low lows. Like when things were good, they felt great. And one of the biggest mistakes I think we made was for us, stopping the bleed felt like, you know, the highs, we felt like we were stopping the bleed. It was like a reset, a reboot. And I know I hear that a lot from the couples that I work with. And, you know, we did get into a cycle of things where things would just get really bad. Sometimes we'd go to therapy. That didn't really help most of the time, or we'd put a Band-Aid on it and things would get really, really bad. There would be explosive tempers. And over the years, that got worse and worse. And, you know, we talk about that a lot on the first episode of how that evolved. But we really thought that stopping the bleed was this return to what felt like calm. It was like, you know, okay, let's just forgive everything, get past it, and then move on. And we would swing back to a high. But in reality, that was like putting a Band-Aid on a hemorrhage. And eventually the Band-Aid couldn't hold, you know. So I know that in my marriage, I ignored the fact that the marriage was really slowly dying over the course of 19 years. But we didn't have a way of knowing that it was just a matter of time that our marriage was going to fail. And we didn't know how to make progress in terms of getting out of the boxing ring. So we would temporarily step out of it, temporarily stop the bleed. And it was like a hit of dopamine to the veins, which is the feel-good hormone. It's like what makes us feel good and have experience joy and pleasure. And so things would be calm for a period of time, but then eventually we'd bleed out again. So Mona, what are your thoughts? And, you know, can you relate to what I'm saying?
Totally. And I said it on the first episode we did together, sex would help us stop the bleed. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how often we use sex to stop the bleed. And that physical connection, that dopamine hit, that oxytocin, I know I needed it big time. And without it, again, I don't think that we would have had as much joy or as many opportunities to reset. And the Band-Aid on the intense bleed sometimes was just, it just wasn't enough. And I think, unfortunately, we didn't go for therapy a lot of times. We did go to a few therapists. And I remember we'd go for one session and we'd say, oh, we could do this ourselves. And then, so it'd be a little bit of a Band-Aid. We'd communicate a little better. And then we'd go back to being toxic. Oftentimes, my ex-husband would shut down and that would help stop the bleed. He would stop engaging with me. And that would stop the bleed. But that wasn't healthy because all that was doing was avoiding having the discussions that we needed to have to be able to resolve the issues that weren't getting resolved. So I guess the bleed was more hemorrhaging inside until, you know, we came to a point where, again, I look at pictures of myself and I'm like, I barely even recognize me sometimes. And I know at the end of our marriage, my ex in a very nasty fight, he said, you've always had weight problems. And yes, I have, because food was my drug of choice and it helped me stop the bleed. And I noticed at times, you know, I would drink more wine or he would drink more beer. That would help stop the bleed. None of these things were healthy for us individually or as a couple. And so it was really, really hard for us to get out of that. I think what you've called, Jody, that intense disconnect in a healthy way. Instead, we did it in very, very unhealthy ways, very unhealthy. And we became very toxic. And I remember, I think it was before we separated, I remember a conversation with my ex, which was, he said something about, it's almost like our relationship is a cancer. Sometimes His words were very harsh, but now, you know, thinking about it, I can laugh about it because I've healed, but thinking about it, he was right. You know, our relationship was a cancer and it was growing and growing and growing. So that's another analogy. And we weren't getting any treatment. We weren't getting chemo or radiation for our cancer. Mm-hmm. Instead, it was just spreading through other parts of our bodies. And I know that I became very, very depressed, and it was affecting how I functioned at work. It was affecting how I parented. It was affecting, you know, everything in my life, my relationship with my ex-husband. So yeah, it was very tough for either one of us to stop the bleed. We knew it needed to be stopped, but we didn't have the strategies or the tools and couldn't find a therapist.
Wow. You know, that the cancer analogy, instead of really getting treatment, we just chop off that part of our body. And it's that figurative part of our body. And I know for me, it's like, you know, I would chop off that part of my identity and just literally disconnect until the point where I literally didn't know who I was. I had no idea who I was. Oftentimes I'll tell a story about how not long before I ended up actually leaving the marriage, I was in a therapy session with my son, who was really struggling with a lot of anxiety at the time. And I know the climate in our home was very much influencing him, but it was a play therapy session. And the therapist that was working with us had the game Jenga, which is like, you know, tower of blocks where you pull out a block and hopefully the tower doesn't fall. But on each block, she had a question written. There were prompts. And so my son was probably 8 or 9 years old. And there were questions like, what makes you scared? When's the last time you laughed? That kind of thing. And we were all three playing, my son, myself, and the therapist. And it became my turn. And so I pulled out my block and it said, what do you do for fun? And I just froze. My son was sitting there with these big eyes looking at me like, yeah, mom, what do you do for fun? And I just froze because I had no answer. I had no idea. And, you know, last episode, we talked about assessing the risk and triaging. I think that was a light bulb moment for me when I realized I don't know who I am anymore. This is something that's very, very wrong. And at that point, it wasn't really long after that that I did find a therapist for myself, not a couples therapist for us, which was a little different. We had gone to therapy together a lot and had had a therapist on our own a few times. But this time I was approaching it from a different perspective because I think this was pivotal in terms of stopping the bleed. And I want to come back to that, but I want to respond to some of what Mona said too, because I can relate to so much of it. Not the sexual relationship. That was not something that my ex and I, that was not part of our pattern that helped us to reboot. As a matter of fact, we were the opposite of that. We could not connect. We struggled to get on the same page sexually. So what we did instead, we were both, like our family, we were sensory seekers and we sought out the next type of excitement. And sometimes that was like going on trips or going to Disney or we would go, you know, out to a movie. I mean, we would actually have date nights and do things. But, you know, he definitely shut down like you described. And one of the ways that he coped with that, he got jobs and really climbed in his career. And he's very successful in his career. And he ended up with jobs that took him all over the world and places that where he would get away from the relationship and just really be kind of, you know, blissing out, going and traveling and seeing all the great things. And then I'd miss him while he was gone. And then he'd come back and we'd miss each other. And it would be like a reset. And then we, as a family, we also moved around a lot, a fair amount, chasing that next exciting thing that gave us dopamine. And, you know, in the middle of it all, and I would say we became addicted to the hits of dopamine, especially if we were really depleted of it. So, you know, we stopped the bleed by seeking out dopamine for ourselves in other kinds of ways. But in the middle of all that, our relationship, our marriage was just literally, this avalanche was starting to snowball and come down a hill, a mountain of disaster, if you will. The marriage itself was completely falling apart, bleeding out. And yet we thought we would both feel better. You know, it would get bad and we'd go seek out some kind of external something. And, you know, some people actually go outside of the marriage sexually. You know, you mentioned sex. Some people think that that's going to fix it. They bring up polyamorous type situations. And I've honestly, as a therapist and relationship coach, I've never really seen that work, particularly if it's the solution to a marriage that's bleeding out. In my own marriage, we self-medicated in various ways. I'm an emotional eater. I eat my feelings. My ex actually went through a period of time where he was self-medicating with drinking, and it had become problematic. And, you know, gosh, just the dysfunctional things that we both did throughout the marriage, I really hyper-focused on my kids, which as a mom, you know, okay, great, you raise your kids. And we had an autistic daughter. We had a son who is now diagnosed as ADHD and had epilepsy when he was young. And I just became like super mom. And that was part of my dopamine. And I really overdid it as a mom. I look back and, you know, there was a lot that was necessary, but that was part of how I ignored the hemorrhage in my marriage that we were experiencing, was by really being this super mom focused, hyper focused on my kids.
Yeah.
So Mona, let's talk to our listeners about how to actually stop the bleed for real and not just throw a Band-Aid at the bleed. I know what I want to say, but I want to give you an opportunity to go first.
No, go for it.
Okay, yeah. So for me, I think that boundaries, personal boundaries, are huge when it comes to stopping the bleed, because, you know, it's something I did not have. You know, I mentioned in the last episode how I really struggled with codependency, which is just a mindset of rescuing others and making sure they're okay, and pretty much living to make sure everybody else is okay and putting myself last. I was taught that as a child from a narcissistic parent who insisted that he be the main priority for everybody in the family. I didn't know how to set a boundary for me. And to be clear, a boundary is when you communicate what you need, what you want, where your line is for yourself. You're not telling someone else what they have to do or what you expect of them. You can make a request, but then they get to honor it or not. So a boundary is then, you know, if you choose to do this or say this, then I'm going to do this for myself. It's not an ultimatum, which is a threat, which dictates someone else's behavior, actions, words. It pretty much tells them what they have to do and what their consequence is if they don't. The difference in that is a boundary is you're making a request, you're stating what your expectations are, but giving that other person full freedom to make their own choices for what, how they, you know, how they respond to that request or those expectations, which really an expectation is not something that's a requirement of someone else. It's just what we are hoping for or what we're expecting, expectation. So with a threat, you're saying basically you have to this or else this is your consequence. Whereas a boundary is like, look, this is what I want. This is what I need. This is what I'm hoping for. You choose what you want to do with that. And then based on your choice, this is what I'm going to choose for myself. So the way boundaries tie into stopping the bleed, we need to look at, and we need to assess the risk, which we talked about in season one, and look at where we're bleeding out the most. What, you know, what is hurting us the most? And some people might go straight to saying, well, what's hurting me the most is that I don't have a connection, or if the answer to that is if he would just, or if she would just, then, you know, fill in the blank, if he would just this, or if she would just that, that may be what's hurting you the most. But when you look at what are you doing yourself that either contributes to that or creates an environment to make that possible, what boundary are you not setting? And I just want to emphasize that this is not easy. And I don't want it to sound like, well, just set your boundary, because that's not an easy thing to do. I know for me personally, and for those of you I work with, we're not really willing sometimes to look at or recognize our boundaries. And it's because we're so accustomed to not valuing ourselves. We want our partner to value us and to just do, you know, what we need to feel valued without us really saying, hey, I really have to have this, or, you know, this is the behavior or the bare minimum for me that I can tolerate or that I have to have in a relationship. And we really have to take ownership of what those boundaries are in order to stop the bleed. We cannot look to our partner to do what we need them or want them to do in order to stop the bleed for us. Mona, what are your thoughts?
I think I had very few boundaries. And I always recommend the book by Nedra Glover Tawab called The Set Boundaries Workbook. And the subtitle is Practical Exercises for Understanding Your Needs and Setting Healthy Limits. Because I think for me, the places where I was not able to stop the bleed, I don't think that I understood how important understanding my codependency was. And then I remember saying to my ex at times that I almost felt like he was a drug to me. And I know that may resonate with some folks out there. And he didn't quite understand what I was saying. And I said, sometimes I feel like I need to be sitting with you. I need you to hold me. I need you to hug me. I need time with you. I think I was so depleted. It's like, you know, maybe the stop the bleed analogy would be like, I was anemic. You know, I was emotionally anemic in the relationship. And I didn't know how to give myself those things that I was looking for from my ex-husband. And it really wasn't his responsibility to do those things for me on a regular basis. And so for me, I had to understand my codependency. And he was absolutely codependent too. We both agreed to that. And there are so many great folks out there that do workshops and classes. And there's, you know, Codependency No More, which is like the seminal work by Melody Beattie. But understanding that I brought codependency to my marriage and working on that for myself was so critical after my divorce. I didn't really understand that during the marriage. And then creating boundaries. And I didn't even know I was creating boundaries, Jody, when I said that I cannot be in this relationship if you are not employed, when he was out of work for, you know, over 7 years, to throw in the, I'm going to divorce your ass if you don't get a job, was not very healthy. It certainly wasn't a boundary, but I was beginning to learn how to set healthy boundaries. And, you know, those boundaries can have time frames on them. So, you know, I could have said, if in the next 6 months you are not employed, whether it's part-time or full-time, I'm going to move forward on a separation. But I didn't. It was a little bit more toxic than that. So yeah, stopping the bleed by setting boundaries and understanding our own codependency and our needs. I didn't understand what my needs were because, like you, I had been a people pleaser. I had been giving, even though I had been asking for things from my ex-husband too. I was bleeding emotionally and didn't know how to stop that.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned setting the boundary about his job, but then saying, I'm going to divorce you. You know, that still is a boundary. But sometimes what happens is we set a boundary, but then our presentation of it is the toxic part. And because it's like, you know, okay, I do have this boundary, but when we add in the critical, the judgmental, the zinger, you know, we're kind of throwing that little dart. That's the part that becomes toxic. And I think it's important that that's why I want to circle back to having our own therapist, because I think it's very important to have a therapist that you can go to. And the therapy is not specifically about the couple relationship. It's not about fixing the relationship, because if the two of you are you're bleeding out and you're in the boxing ring and it's highly antagonistic, I think that there's inherently an issue there with going straight into trying to fix the marriage. And I won't do that with the couples that come to me. And unfortunately, that's what therapists did with my husband, my ex-husband. They went straight into trying to fix the relationship when nobody stopped to say, hey, are you actually compatible? Or is there a compatibility issue here? Is there an alignment issue? What's actually going on here? What's really causing these issues? And there's just this mindset of all marriages should be saved no matter what. And this is a really difficult concept for especially for the faith-based community, but not just the faith-based community, but I definitely see it there. And I've had some pretty extensive conversations with Stephanie Holmes and her husband, Dan. They're both ministers, if you're not familiar with them. They're neurodiverse professionals. They're in a mixed neurotype marriage and work exclusively with the faith-based community. And it's a very hard thing for a lot of people who are faith-based to recognize or to acknowledge or even being willing to consider that their marriage is not aligned. And if that's destroying both people, it doesn't need to continue. And Stephanie and Dan agree that it's very hard. But when I work with a couple and the marriage is salvageable, and then they really grow and they become enlightened, they learn how to set boundaries in their marriage. They learn how to connect and communicate. But some marriages are not going to be salvageable. And that's the reality of it. Mona, you and I've talked about how there were so many reasons why we stayed, and whether it was our faith or just loving our partners, you know, really loving them. I loved my ex-husband. I still care about him. I'll always love him. And I care for his well-being. There's so many things about him that I genuinely like. And I think he's just a genuinely really cool person in a lot of ways. But ultimately, we were not compatible. And because I didn't have my own boundaries for myself when we met, when we got married, you know, one of the things that I said in the last episode is I thought being low maintenance was this just desirable trait as a girlfriend and as a wife. But what that really meant is I didn't have any boundaries for myself in terms of my own needs, my own preferences, my own expectations. And then I didn't know how to say, I want this, I need this. Or when I did say it, it would come out as very, it would be resentful, critical. And I wanted him to rescue me in the way I was rescuing him. And that was, as we said, that was how we say in Georgia, a hot mess.
Yeah. And I think for me, in some ways, I had a little bit of the opposite situation where I was a little bit more clear about what I needed and wanted, but my delivery was oftentimes off. So it was very emotional, or it was screaming, or it was demanding. And my ex very rarely shared what he wanted. Very rarely. It wasn't until we separated and he was living on his own for the first time, and then he found his voice. But during our marriage, it was almost like he was more of a people pleaser and, you know, that codependency, wanting to do whatever I asked of him. And I think the bleeding for us kept happening because he would agree to do things and then not follow through. Mm-hmm. And so that can be a real challenge. And when we don't understand we're in a neurodiverse relationship, we may think that we can't trust our partners. And that's where I got. I felt like I couldn't trust him anymore because he wasn't following through on a lot of things he said he would do. And I think he said he would do it because he wanted to stop the bleed. He wanted to get out of the boxing ring. He wanted to shut me up in the nicest of ways, but he was actually not being trustworthy. And that created more harm. And I think that created, like, if something was scabbing over, every time he did that, the scab came off and, you know, the bleeding just started full force. And there's one thing that I wanted to talk about in relation to having your own therapist. I think that's really important. I think for both partners, if you're willing and able, and if a therapist doesn't work for you, a coach or somebody, a clergy person, or even a best friend or a mentor. But I do remember something that happened in our marriage that freaked me out. It just absolutely freaked me out. Something my ex had done. He had a camera in a room, a closet that we had, and he had it going like all the time because he was afraid that my daughter's friends might play with the electrical stuff he had in that room and start a fire. I didn't know he had a camera there. And I remember finding out, and I can't tell you, Jody, how I found out, but that was a major hemorrhage, right? And I literally said to him, you are going with me to my therapist, who's my private therapist, my personal therapist, because I don't understand what you did. I don't understand why you did it. And you have literally just destroyed my trust in you in like a split second. And I hear this oftentimes with the neurodiverse couples who come into my support groups, that one thing that one of the partners thought was an okay thing to do and never thought about the other partner's perspective or their feelings or emotions, and it can, like, the bleed can turn into a hemorrhage. And I think that's when it's so critical to have that therapist or coach who understands neurodiverse couples to literally translate what just happened, because my therapist was not neurodiverse affirming or understanding, and she didn't know. I mean, she was as shocked as I was. So
I would so agree with what you just said about how one person may do or say something and really have no idea how that's going to affect the partner. And I do think this actually happens on both sides of a mixed neurotype relationship. It's so baffling and it's confusing and shocking and it's unsettling. So then that kicks us into that fight or flight response where we don't feel safe. And really, when we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, safety is very much down there at the bottom with food, water, shelter. And if you all of a sudden feel like you don't know the person or you don't know what's going to happen next, then there's not safety there. I had several incidents in our relationship that are not identical to yours, but several incidents where I felt unsafe or I felt my children weren't safe from the decisions that my ex made that I didn't understand. And I mean, he loves his kids. He was never intentionally trying to put them in harm or in harm's way, but he made some decisions that were unsafe for them or decisions that were unsafe for me at times. And that's baffling and confusing because this is somebody that you expect make you and your safety a priority. So when you have a partner who's not a people pleaser, but also not someone who can assess and recognize safety and make sure you are safe and your children are safe, which is a more balanced type of dynamic, then it can be very frightening and unsettling. And something I want to clarify about codependency in a relationship and how it's applicable to these issues of safety, because safety is very much related to boundaries. And so I want to just clarify what codependency is, because a lot of people misunderstand what it means. Codependency is not the same as being dependent on someone else. Some people think that it means that one partner is financially dependent or needs the other person to support them from a provisional type of standpoint. But codependent partners, like Mona and I, were both very able. We were very competent women and able to take care of ourselves. But being codependent, we will take care of others at our own expense, even though we're still very competent. So it's not about being dependent on someone else. But the people-pleasing part of codependency is that need to make sure others are okay, even if it means you're not okay. And so sometimes someone can be a codependent people pleaser with one person, like a partner, but not a people pleaser in other areas or with someone else, with a different partner. So a codependent personality means you've got this tendency to be a giver or you have a tendency to be a receiver. So, you know, in my relationship with my ex-husband, I was the giver and he was more of a receiver or taker, in that we revolved very much around him and what he really wanted and what he really needed. And if he wasn't getting that, then he got very dysregulated. And I felt like it was my job to make sure he was getting what he needed and what he wanted. But then I also felt like it was my job to help him regulate, which meant giving up myself and my own needs at times. But yet, interestingly, he was a people pleaser with his mother and father, really. Going back to a story I told in episode one of the series, you know, he would put her needs ahead of his own sometimes. So codependency is this dysfunctional dynamic in the way that we, people with codependency, don't have those boundaries. And it's very important to have a therapist for yourself that understands codependency and preferably neurodivergence, if at all possible, because it's very critical in a neurodiverse relationship to learn how to set your boundaries. And, you know, I can remember one of the first times I set a boundary for myself. And it was, I guess, leaving my marriage was a huge boundary that I set for myself because it had become so toxic and dangerous that it was unsafe for him, for me, for our children. But then after I divorced and I dated for a few years off and on, I was in a relationship with a man for a couple of years who was also neurodivergent. It was a mixed neurotype relationship. And honestly, the neurodiversity wasn't the biggest issue. But when COVID happened, he was it became a special interest of his, and he was just fascinated at the beginning. And, you know, here in the U.S., the toilet paper and everything was just flying off the shelves. The shelves were empty, and he wanted to go to the stores two or three times a week just to see what was going on. He was very curious and excited and invested in it, and it became a special interest. And we weren't living together, but we lived very near each other, about a mile away, and I worked out of his home. I had a little office set up in his house and in my house, and I worked out of his house a lot. And I remember telling him, because I felt very unsafe physically. It was early in the COVID situation where we didn't know who was going to die if they got COVID. It was just very scary. And I remember telling him, if you want to continue going to the stores, that's your choice. That's your right. You can do that. I'm not telling you to stop. But I'm telling you, if you do continue doing that, then I'm going to start working out of my house most days. And we'll figure out when we can see each other, maybe on the weekends on a limited basis, or maybe take walks or something out in the open with fresh air. But I need to do this for my own safety. And that was a huge thing for me to set that boundary, because he actually got very upset. And we ultimately ended the relationship because of my boundary. And this particular person, he couldn't tolerate having a boundary set. And it wasn't related to his neurodivergence at all. He had some other toxic personality traits, and my boundary outraged him. But I stood the boundary. And whereas in the past, the people-pleasing part of me probably would have compromised, I likely would have compromised my own safety in order to make him feel okay. And I would have just minimized my concern for myself and maybe even tried to convince myself that it wasn't that bad, or that I was overreacting or exaggerating the danger. So I wanted to just give an example of that. And, you know, in that situation, I didn't tell him what he had to do, but I let him know what I needed to do if he made certain choices.
Yeah, it's so important, Jody. And until we learn how to set boundaries, and I always tell folks, start with some of the smaller things if you're in the process of learning, you know, whether it's, I would like us to share the responsibilities in the house, let's sit down and make a list, and then we decide you're going to do this, I'm going to do this. And if we don't follow through, then I'm going to be hiring a cleaning service. You know, that's a boundary. But there's so many in this, you know, the Set Boundaries workbook. I just absolutely love it. And I think one of the things that can be so difficult, and why we can then kind of scrape the scab off and then start bleeding again, is that when we set boundaries and we've never done it before in our relationships, it can really put our partners in a tailspin. And they may start treating us in ways that we are not comfortable with. And so we go back on our boundaries and we walk away from what we need or want to feel safe or to feel comfortable in the relationship. And safety is not necessarily physical, although we've talked about that, could be emotional safety. And I think we need to practice setting boundaries, you know, maybe even talking to ourselves and kind of scripting it out sometimes, and maybe starting again with the smaller things, or starting with people we know are not going to push back and maybe get in an argument or a fight with us. But I remember with the first guy I dated long-term after my marriage ended, after my divorce, I set a few boundaries with him because he was a screamer. It's funny how the world gives you what you were so that you can see yourself in action. But he was a screamer and he had no control of his anger when he was dysregulated. You know, turns out he was neurodivergent and he kept asking me. But I said to him, and this was a boundary that I had to set, when you scream at me, I will leave the room. I will either go into the bedroom and close the door and lock the door, or I will get in my car and I will go, you know, to the store or just drive around. And he said to me, please don't ever leave the house. And I said, okay, then I will be going into the bedroom and locking the door. And you can, you know, knock or text when you've calmed down and can have a civil conversation. What a wonderful boundary.
What a wonderful negotiation. You know, setting a boundary doesn't mean it's going to be like, okay, it's my way or the highway. That's more of an ultimatum. You can set that boundary, present it to your partner like Mona did. And if the partner says, okay, you know, if we can negotiate something that works well for both of us, then that's a boundary for him too. He's setting a boundary too. And he said, you know, please don't leave. That's going to be too much for me. And you both, then you set that boundary in the middle somewhere that you could both live with. And that's a great example.
Yeah, it was. And I didn't understand. And he shared this with me when he calmed down and we were both more regulated, that, you know, that was something that had gone on in his family of origin. You know, his father had left the house. And when he was a kid, that destroyed him. You know, his father would leave the house when his mother and his father would get in a fight. So, yeah. And I think the more we understand about also our own trauma and our family of origin and our partner's family of origin and their trauma, the more we can be compassionate and give each other grace, But if we don't stop the bleeding and the toxicity and take our boxing gloves off, at some point, we're going to get to the point where we're not going to have anything related to a healthy relationship.
Right. And I think that's actually a perfect segue into what the next episode is going to be about, which is to identify the actual root problems. We can't really get to underneath the surface and look at those root issues or even look at ourselves and figure out exactly what we really want and need until we stop the bleed. Because when we're bleeding out, we literally keep ourselves in a state of fight, flight, fawn, or freeze. And it's that hypervigilant reaction mode that our bodies are built, that's built in to survive. Our brains have built it in. It's built in. And when we feel unsafe emotionally or psychologically, physically, because we're not setting and holding boundaries, that's the bleeding out. And we remain in a state of fighting or running or shutting down. Fawning is also a pleasing type of response. Freezing is just literally, freezing is just literally like going nonverbal, especially for autistic individuals. If you've had a lot of trauma, you may just freeze and you can't say or do anything. And as long as we're bleeding out and that intensity of the problems is so high, then you stay in that state of fight or flight and your frontal lobes literally don't get blood flow. I mean, the blood flow, the frontal lobes is the part of the brain where we have the ability to really think and reason and make sense of things. And that part of our body, our brain doesn't get as much blood flow when we're in fight or flight because our brain is helping us to literally run from danger, to fight the danger or freeze and be still so we can't be detected. You know, that's a primitive reflexive response that keeps us alive. But if we live in that space every day and we're just constantly fighting, fleeing, hiding, shutting down, and not actually able to stop and really think through and reason and figure out solutions and make sense of our relationship, then we're never going to move forward. And that's why I think this individual work with a therapist is critical to getting the bleeding stopped. If you do go to a couples therapist, I recommend that you make sure that it's someone who will see you individually as well as together. All the therapists that I know, that especially the ones that are in the neurodivergent relationship space that work with couples, all of them work with individual partners separately, sometimes before they even see you together much at all. I usually do a hybrid of both, but it's important to have that one-on-one time with a therapist so that you can really figure out yourself and how to get your own boxing gloves off. And it starts with setting those boundaries. You know, what happens during conflict, how to end that conflict in a way that's setting a boundary for what you're going to do or how you handle the conflict. And it's also about setting boundaries that are proactive to avoid getting into these really intense high conflict situations or unsafe situations. And the bleed is about identifying the areas in your life that are harming you the most, and even your partner the most, and your family. But the only person you can really focus on is yourself. And that's the only person that you can only change your own behavior, your own words, your own actions. And that's why the individual work with a therapist or a coach is so important. Mona, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, again, it's just so hard sometimes to stop the bleed because we put a Band-Aid on it, we get some stitches, the stitches break open, the Band-Aid comes off, and, you know, we're looking for sometimes the quick fix. Because mm-hmm. I'll just say this, sometimes we're afraid of the marriage or the relationship ending. I know I had that fear. So I think as we move forward in the series, it's going to be really helpful for folks to think about, you know, what Jody and I went through, whether you want to join us in the support group that we co-facilitate, or whether you want a therapist or a coach to help you move forward. But neither one of us are pro-divorce. But what we are supportive of is healthy relationships.
And healthy people.
And healthy people, yes. Mm-hmm. And neurodiversity or neurodivergence is just one piece of the puzzle. As we've talked about, there's so many other things that come into play when we're in a romantic relationship with somebody we love, who we all have our own baggage and our own stuff that we bring, and we may not be aware of a lot of it.
I think that one of the things that I've said to clients that has resonated or hit the hardest. And this is something that I realized about my own marriage when I look back. If you're in the cycle of putting a Band-Aid on the bleed, it's not a matter of if your relationship fails, it's a matter of when. And it will eventually either fail or the two of you will just become roommates. There will be just a disconnect and you will just be living separate lives in a parallel way. And I've seen that a lot with my clients. And it's so important to realize that being afraid of it ending, I know that motivated me. I didn't want it to end. It was easier at times to believe that we'd just figure it out eventually. It was going to end, though. And it got so scary dangerous toward the end because we were both so dysregulated. So just know that if you're bleeding out and you're in the boxing ring and you recognize this cycle of reset, reboot, throw that temporary Band-Aid on, then it's very important that you get to a therapist or coach who can help you learn how to start setting boundaries for yourself. And you can only do you. It's not a matter of, well, you know, my partner won't go, my partner needs to learn about neurodiversity, my partner needs to figure out so many things about himself or herself. That mindset is so dysfunctional and not going to get the outcome for you that you actually want.
And if you can't afford it, go and find a mental health facility that offers counseling on a sliding scale. I think that's so important because one of the things that I see over and over again, Jody, and I knew this for myself, is I can't tell you how many people end up with serious physical problems, health problems. I've had folks in both my couple support groups and my non-autistic neurotypical support groups tell me they've had strokes, they have autoimmune disease, they have cancer, all kinds of fibromyalgia, all kinds of issues. And I know it goes both ways. When your body is always in that response, it can cause inflammation and can cause problems that you may not even be aware of. And then it becomes a crisis. So stopping the bleed also requires you to think about how what you're going through now may be impacting your physical and mental health.
100%. I experienced that myself. I was diagnosed with an autoimmune illness about 10 years into the marriage, and it was my body really, really struggling for years. And my ex-husband actually had some pretty significant health issues too. At one point, he was even hospitalized for about 4 days because he just couldn't stay conscious. His body was literally shutting him down, and he could be awakened. It wasn't like he was in a coma. They could wake him up, but he would only stay awake for about 3 minutes, and then he would just go back to sleep. And this was for 4 days or so. And they never, ever identified what was wrong. But looking back, that was during some of that was around the same time I was diagnosed with an autoimmune illness that has resolved, interestingly, now. Those symptoms have resolved for me once I did start setting boundaries and started becoming healthy for myself. And that did involve ending my marriage. And I don't really know much about his health since our marriage. I can only speak for me that it made a pretty huge difference once, you know, I stopped the bleed. And for me, it did involve ending the marriage. But and that's what we're going to talk about on the next episode is once you've assessed the risk, you've triaged it, you've focused on stopping the bleeds. Today, we talked about setting boundaries to stop the bleed. And next, we're going to talk about once you've set those boundaries and you're able to not be in fight or flight constantly, that's when you can actually look at your options and see what you've actually got. What are you dealing with? Are there deal breakers? Is this something that can be salvaged? So we're going to talk about that on our next episode. Thank you again to Mona Kay for co-hosting this very important podcast series about navigating the choices and decisions that are difficult to make in our neurodiverse relationships. For more information about the courses, programs, coaching, and groups that Mona and I both offer, you can visit my website at jodycarlton.com and Mona's website at neurodiverselove.com. Be sure to subscribe or follow to get updates about new episodes.